Good morning, online friends. It's good to be with you here. I'm glad that you've joined us, giving us your time and energy. And this morning, we're going to be observing communion. And so if you want to grab wine, juice, bread substitute, whatever it is, now would be a good time to do so. We're going to get towards that at the end of the service, but I thought I'd keep you up to date on what's happening in our live services this Sunday. We'll be doing communion, and there's a lot of hoops to jump through to keep things safe. And so we ended up having to purchase these. I don't know if you can see that there. It's an individualized little communion cup. It's got a wafer on the top, juice on the bottom. That is what we'll be using Sunday at the Conrad Center. It feels like a bit of an abomination to me having these little individualized packets, but that's the plan. I'm going to test run one of these right now at the end of the service, and so we'll see how that goes. But communion's coming up this morning, and I hope you will join us in that. Well, this morning we are in our third week of exploring our collective path and practices here at Nexus. And so this week we're on practice number two. And our second practice has everything to do with how people can belong and participate here at Nexus. Belonging and participation. And what we're striving to be here as a community is an equitable community of mutual dignity and respect. And so I want to unpack that a little bit for us this morning, eventually get to communion as well. But what I want to do is I want to talk about guest lists or being a guest somewhere and the awkward, sometimes interactions we experience when we're on a list, when we're guests somewhere. So I want to tell you two stories, and I'm going to come back to these stories later in the teaching. But this past summer, my little good time pastor pal group was getting together. It had been a long time, so we're very excited about this meeting. One of the pastors was hosting at his place outside. This was going to be great, and so we even put together an agenda for a meeting. And so, you know, we had all these different theological, pastory things on there, one of which included this interesting new idea of soft robot exorcism. I'll explain that sometime down the future, but exciting little new idea coming out of the theological world, and so we're excited to talk about it. We got our agenda together, show up to the meeting. I'm so excited. Sit down. We're getting together, and the host, one of my good pastor friends, he says, "Now, guys, I hope you don't mind, but I've invited my son and some of his friends to hang out with us as well." And I don't tend to love situations where I don't know things are going to happen. And so I was unprepared for this, you could say. I was a little thrown off by this sudden inclusion of additional guests. And so I'm thinking, oh, I don't know, are we going to get to the soft robot exorcism? What about our agenda? This wasn't on the agenda. And so sure enough, his son and his friends join us, and I end up sitting next to this one guy, and it's one of those situations, right, where you're making small talk, you want to be friendly, you want to show an interest in the person beside you. I'm trying to do all that, and I learned this guy's interested in hockey cards. So he starts telling me all about his hockey card passion and obsession, and I'll be honest, I enjoy hockey cards, collecting them, not really my thing. And so I'm listening to him, and he's kind of spouting off all the cards, you know, hey, I've got an Auston Matthews rookie card, going through this whole list. And I'll be honest, in my head, I was so bored. This is not what I had signed up for. And then there was this moment where I had a feeling it was coming. I didn't know how to handle it, but he said, "Would you like to see my hockey card collection?" And of course, everything in my head is screaming, "No, that sounds incredibly boring. I don't want to see your hockey card collection." But again, I'm trying to be nice, invest in the people around me. And so I agree. And he brings out his hockey card collection. We spend like an hour and a half looking through these different hockey cards. And I'm trying to be interested, but oh, I'm bored. And then I'm like, are we going to get on with our meeting? This is totally unexpected. And they don't seem to be leaving. And so we get into talking about other things. And he eventually brings up the Mandela effect. I'd never heard of this before, but it's, you know, you remember things differently than the way they are. And so he starts going through these things, and he and I, we end up arguing a little, because he says to me, "Now, Brad, could you tell me in Star Wars the color of C-3PO?" And I said, "Well, of course, he's a gold robot." And he, with a bit too much pleasure, is like, incorrect, sir. Actually, C-3PO is all gold, but his one leg from the knee down is silver. And I'm like, are you kidding me? No, it's not. I've watched all the Star Wars movies. He's gold. He's all gold. And he's like, precisely. That's Mandela effect. You aren't remembering. You're wrong, Brad. And I'm like, what are you talking about? So now we're getting a little, you know, a little heated going at it. And finally, he's like, okay, I'll give you another example. Brad, tell me Forrest Gump's line, his famous line in the Forrest Gump movie. And I said, what do I look like, brand new here? I said, it's life is like a box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. And he's like, wrong again, sir. What Forrest Gump actually says is life was like a box of chocolates. And at this point, I'm like, I got no patience for this kid. I'm like, listen, I grew up with that movie, okay? He says life is like a box of chocolates. And so, you know, we're arguing. He's convinced I'm wrong. I'm convinced he's dead wrong. And this is going on and on. And all the time, I'm like, who invited these people? These people weren't on the invite list. How did they end up here? And now I'm stuck talking about hockey cards and Forrest Gump. It was, oh, one of those situations. How did I end up here? I didn't ask to be around these people. Or consider this second story. You see, Kristen made friends when she went to school in Quebec and Moncton, and so one of them was getting married in Peterborough. Kristen was excited. Oh, we get to go to a wedding. This is going to be great. I said, do I have to go? Because I don't really know these people. And Kristen's like, well, you are my husband. So yeah, okay. So things weren't getting any better though when I learned that we're going to have to stay in the night and that the process for the wedding is they were out on a farm. And so you catch a bus at 2 and the bus takes you out to the farm. And I was thinking, oh my goodness, well, is there like an hourly bus ride back? And she's like, no, the bus will then pick us all up at midnight. So now I'm thinking, my goodness, I'm stuck for 10 hours at this place and I don't know anyone. I'm a guest on the list, but I'm not sure I really want to be here. And, you know, we get through the wedding. It's nice, whatever. You know, we take our seats for the reception. And of course, we go and we look at her name. Where are we sitting? Oh, with people we don't know. So we arrive at our table and it becomes clear very quickly that we've been saddled with Cousin Tommy. And Cousin Tommy, I think you could say, had a few drinks that afternoon. The moment he arrived at the table, I knew trouble was brewing. And so over the course of the evening, the meal, he was drinking very, very heavily, Cousin Tommy was, to the point that he started spilling things. So at one point in the meal, he knocked over a wine bottle on the table. We're like, there goes our table's wine, and he's getting slurry with his speech. He's starting to get loud and embarrassing, and I'm thinking, how did we get stuck at this table with Cousin Tommy? This is, I don't want to be at Cousin Tommy's table. This is ridiculous. I don't like this at all. And then, you know, he's getting louder and louder as he drinks more, and at one point, he's got his wine glass up, and he's talking right through the parents of the bride's speech, right? And I'm trying to give him the eye, like, hey, keep it down. And somebody at the table says, Tommy, they're doing a speech. And he's like, oh, all right. And he drops his wine glass, and it shatters on the floor in the middle of the speech, all this commotion. I'm like, oh, I don't want to be at a table with a bumbling drunk fool. It was so embarrassing. Like, how did I get saddled on the guest list, not only with people I don't know, but awkward Cousin Tommy? Being a guest at someone else's party when someone else is hosting is a risky endeavor. You never know who you're going to end up beside. You can end up talking about hockey cards or next to bumbling Cousin Tommy. There's huge risks in showing up to a party where you're not the host, where you haven't been the one who has invited the guests. And I want us to keep in mind this morning as we look at this practice, the idea of guests and guest lists, because I think it will speak into the nature of what we're trying to do here at Nexus. So in full, this is our practice of belonging and participation at Nexus. We are striving to be an equitable community of mutual dignity and respect. We understand all people to be made in the image of God, and as such, we will work to affirm the worth and dignity of everyone. We strive to be a church community that practices welcoming, accepting, and serving all people without qualification. We want there to be no barriers to belonging or participating at Nexus, regardless of economic power, gender, mental health, physical ability, race, sexuality, age, or ethnicity. We are striving to treat everyone with respect and dignity. Now, a few things to point out there about that statement. The first is that we, as Jesus Path people, following the Jesus Path, we believe everyone is made in the image of God. And as such, it means that all of us are equal, no matter what privileges or statuses we have in life. Everyone under the eyes of God is equal. And I have to say, this might seem like, okay, that seems pretty straightforward. But without this sort of bedrock belief, I don't think that it's intuitively obvious that everyone actually is created equal. There's some hoops you have to jump through to get there. But what the Jesus Path insists is this: everyone is a child of God. Everyone contains a spark of the divine in them. Everyone is made in God's image. And because of that, everyone must be treated the same. Everyone must be afforded dignity and worth and respect. And so it becomes our job at Nexus, I believe, to make sure that there are no barriers to people feeling like they belong at Nexus or feeling like they can participate in the life of the community. Now, it's one thing to sort of give that affirmation via words. It's one thing to sort of give that lip service that everyone here can belong and participate without qualification. But how do you enact that? How do you make that known? How do you declarize that, declare that, you could say? Well, for us, there's a second paragraph in this practice of ours, and I wanted to read it to you because this is how we believe at Nexus we make this known. At Nexus, our primary expression of this practice is found in the ritual of Eucharist communion, where our table is open to anyone and everyone. From its beginning, the table has served as the practice of having people who would never normally associate with one another sit together as equals. We see this practice as a subversive political event for all who participate. In the words of Richard Beck, it brings real people divided in the larger world into a sweaty, intimate, flesh and blood embrace where there shall be no differences between them and the rest. This is what we believe and hold to be true, that anyone can belong completely and participate totally without any qualification here at Nexus. And we believe the best way to showcase that, to animate it, bring that to life, is via the ritual of Eucharist communion, the table, where our table is wide open. Anyone can serve, anyone can receive. And this has become important to us. You know, leadership over the summer was reviewing our collective practices and decided when working through this one that if this is true, that we are a community that wants everyone to feel like they can belong and participate, and if Eucharist is the way to express that, animate that, bring that to life, then we ought to do this more often. And so that's our plan for this year, actually, going forward, is to not just do, as we have in the past, Eucharist, you know, occasionally, but to make it something more intentional, to animate it well, and to try to do it once a month, once every 6 weeks, something like that. So that is our plan going forward. But having said that, I think a fair question here about this practice might be this: why is our primary expression of belonging and participating, why is that the ritual of Eucharist? I mean, why a ritual at all? That's a great question. Let me start by saying this. I think rituals are important for two reasons. And the first is this: rituals, they help us to remember. They help us stay awake and aware. And, you know, culturally, I think we understand this through our sort of culturally mandated rituals, you could say, right? Like, we've got Valentine's Day, Family Day, Mother's Day, Father's Day, all these things. And I know for a lot of us, it's like, oh, those holidays, like, they're so Hallmark-driven, right? But I think there's, at the bottom line, at least a recognition, right, that, okay, these are good because they help us remember. Because we might say something like, I don't need Valentine's Day to show my partner that I love them. But the reality is, a lot of times Valentine's Day sneaks up and you think to yourself, huh, I'm not sure I've give an expression to my love to my partner anytime recently. And so it's a nice reminder. That's the thing about rituals, is they help us remember, whether it's family day, a long weekend, Mother's Day, Father's Day, they help us remember the important things in life. So it is with the table, with Eucharist communion. You know, the whole thing can, you know, at times feel a bit silly, especially when you're drinking out of, you know, something like this. The whole thing can feel a bit silly at times, but the reality is we need rituals like this to help us remember the important things. And on the Jesus path, Jesus has asked us to do this ritual as a way of reminding us of what's important, of reminding us about the Jesus path and what it means to follow and take up your cross. And so we do this as a way of remembering, but rituals are more than about just remembering. I think second, we need rituals because we need the bizarreness of rituals to break up the banality of life. You know, life can become, for I think many of us, so dull and mundane, especially in this time of COVID where every day seems to bleed into to one. It can feel a lot of times like you're living in your own personal Groundhog Day. And bizarre rituals, I think, serve as a way of breaking up the mundane, the ordinary, and giving moments significance. And I think it is like this in the church. You see, I think church can become ordinary and predictable. And by revisiting the storied rituals of our tradition, I think it helps enliven us. It breaks up what becomes common. And again, I think we understand this culturally with our own social norms. I mean, consider birthdays, right? I don't know who came up with the idea, but you can imagine someone at some point going, oh my goodness, hey, tomorrow is Bob's birthday. We should really do something for Bob to celebrate his birthday. We don't want it to be just like any other day for him. It's a day to celebrate, so we should do something for Bob. You know, and I can imagine some friends standing around going, what should we do, right? And then somebody's got the idea, I've got it. Why don't we take a cake and light it on fire for Bob? And I don't know who first approved of this lighting cakes on fire with birthday candles thing, but when you think about it, is a very strange thing to do. You light it on fire, then you blow it out, and it's like, what was that? That's bizarre when you take a step back and consider the ritual itself, and yet it's precisely in being bizarre that makes something special. Consider May Long Weekend, like, hey, how are we going to celebrate the Queen's birthday? And, you know, I can't imagine exactly how this came about, but I'm imagining at some point somebody said, you know what, this is a special day. We get a day off work. I've got an idea, folks. Why don't we light off fireworks so that everyone in the neighborhood feels like they're in the middle of a war zone? And I can see friends sort of scratching their head going, I don't know, but like, what are you thinking? 1 p.m., 2 p.m.? And this guy being like, no, let's do this right when everyone's going to bed, so it surprises them, and they feel very scared at night, and their dogs are scared. Let's do it right at 11 p.m. when most people are trying to go to sleep. And I don't know why that ritual has stuck, but it seems that on special days like Victoria Day weekend, Canada Day weekend, whatever, that we seem to want to make the day special by lighting things on fire and making explosions for everyone to be annoyed by. I'm not sure why that is, but that's what we do. And the bizarreness of it, I suppose, is what makes it special. It's the same goes with weddings. I don't know about you, but our wedding, in hindsight, for Kristen and I, just feels bizarre in retrospect. I mean, for the big day, I decided it would be appropriate to rent a top hat and cane. So there I am, dressed up as some sort of Victorian English gentleman, like, is it like what is that? So I got a top hat and cane, and it's like, what? That makes no sense, Brad. That's not your style. That makes no sense. But it does have a certain sense to it. You want that day to stand out and be special, and so you do something weird, something bizarre, and it's in the bizarreness that things and moments are made special. So it is with the table, with Eucharist. It's precisely in being bizarre and unordinary that this ritual makes the moment special. It becomes meaningful. And at Nexus, the practice of the table or the Eucharist is significant in my mind for a whole host of reasons. We can get to those another time. But I think this ritual is the perfect ritual that sums up our practice of wanting everyone to belong without barriers, to be able to participate without barriers. In fact, it's interesting because for the earliest Christians, this ritual was the glue around who they were and what brought them together. For the earliest Christians, this was very important. And yet what's interesting is that in Scripture, we have very few examples of communities doing this ritual well. In fact, we learn better about the ritual of Eucharist through the ways these communities did it wrong. And I've told you before about the mess in the Corinth church and Paul writing to them and scolding them for how they were doing the Eucharist practice, the Lord's Supper. But it's worth revisiting just briefly. You see, for the earliest Christians, communion, Eucharist, it was a meal. It was a love feast where you got together and everybody shared a meal and everybody was seen as equal. And I mean, this was wild in those days. The thoughts of men and women, Jew and Gentile, masters and slaves, like sitting down at the same table and eating, it's just wild. It's unheard of in this day. And yet this was what bound these communities together. It was powerful. It brought these people who had no business sitting and eating together around a table together as a family, you could say. And this is what it was supposed to be. But Paul writes to them in 1 Corinthians and it's like, you have made a mockery of this thing, because what is happening is the rich were getting together earlier, eating all the food, drinking all the wine. The slaves, those who couldn't afford to get off work during the day, would show up later and there's nothing left to eat, nothing left to drink. They had taken this radical ritual that symbolizes equality under God's eyes, that we're all God's children, no matter qualifications or status in life. And they've taken this and they've just made it a mockery. They've made another hierarchy. The rich, the powerful get together earlier. They eat all the food. They drink all the wine. And then the others show up and feel like the second-class citizens that they are. And for Paul, this is an abomination. What have you done? He's saying, I don't even recognize what you're doing. You've got to change this up. You've got to correct yourself. And that's the same sort of attitude we want to bring to this ritual here at Nexus. This is, again, about everyone is worthy of the same respect and dignity. We see participation in the table as a moral act. From its beginning, the table has served as the practice of having people who would never normally associate with one another sit together as equals. We see this practice as a subversive political event for all who participate, as it brings real people divided in the larger world into a sweaty, intimate, flesh and blood embrace where there shall be no difference between them and the rest. That's what this ritual is about. That's what it's trying to animate, enact, make real. That as we all come to the table and take the elements, what we're declaring is we're all equals here. Everyone has the right to belong. Everyone has the right to participate without qualification. But to do that, we need to see this ritual with the correct lens. Here's the reality of the practice, and I think what the table means for us here at Nexus. This is Jesus' table. He is the host. We don't get control over the guest list. He has invited us to come, sit, eat, and drink with fellow guests. The only question for us is whether we want to participate or not. I think that's so important to remember. We don't get control of the guest list. All of us here at Nexus are simply participants. People who have been invited to a table. I mean, consider my earlier stories of awkward guest encounters. I mean, consider my first story. I show up at this gathering thinking that it's a pastor's gathering. It's going to be essentially my kind of people, pastors, my people, you could say, people that I know and are familiar with. And when I arrive, I'm shocked to learn that the host has invited others. And in that moment, I had a choice. Do I leave and say, well, this isn't what I signed up for. I wanted to be around only pastors, only people like me. Or do I sit, eat, drink, and participate? Now, here's the thing. I stayed, of course. I stayed and participated, and even though my head wasn't, you know, fully in the game, even though I was annoyed, I was a guest. And the host makes the rules, not me. The host makes the guest list, not me. And so I participated even though it was tough. I mean, what happened when I stayed was I realized that this guy was talking to me about his hockey card passion. It's something I have zero interest in. And, you know, I like to think of this as something that's going to happen at Jesus' table all the time. You get to know those people around the table, the people in this community, and suddenly you realize these people have passions that are of zero interest to me. And that's okay. Not everyone around the table, not everyone in this community is going to share our same passions. What I also learned that evening is that when you're around a table with guests, and particularly guests who wouldn't be people that you would have invited, what I learned that evening was this: you come to know some people and you realize that they think you're dead wrong about a whole lot of things. And so I'm talking with this young guy, right? And he thinks he knows more about C-3PO because of the Mandela Effect. He's convinced there's the silver leg. I'm convinced he's all gold. I'm like, no, you're wrong. And he's like, no, you're wrong. And we're back and forth, or we're talking about Forrest Gump. Life is like a box of chocolates, not life was like a box of chocolates. We're each convinced the other is dead wrong. So it is at the table, at Jesus' table. There are going to be people around here, people that we communicate with, people in community who believe we are dead wrong about certain things. And it will work that way back and forth. But that's just the nature of Jesus' table. You don't leave because somebody thinks you're wrong about something. You say, well, I've been invited as a guest. I think this person is wrong, but I'm here as a guest. I don't make the rules. I don't control the guest list. So I will eat, sit, drink with these people around me. Or consider the wedding I attended where Cousin Tom was making a bumbling fool out of himself. And all I kept thinking at that table that evening was, can someone please get rid of Cousin Tommy? He's making a fool of himself. He's making a fool of our table. Can somebody please, can we do something? Can we say, you know what, Tommy, you've had too much to drink. You can't belong at our table anymore. You're going to have to go somewhere else. Or can we cut him off somehow? You know, all of these things that I would love to do, because at my table, I'm looking at him. He's an embarrassment and he's embarrassing me. And what I realized at the wedding is that Cousin Tommy was there because he meant something to the couple being married. Cousin Tommy might look like a fool to me, but Cousin Tommy has a place of love in the hearts of the couple that's being married. He is their guest. He is there as a special person to them. And so I don't get to make the rules. I just have to agree, okay, I'm here as a guest, and maybe Cousin Tommy is going to be a little bit foolish, but he's loved by the couple. And so I sit there, I deal with it, I try to enjoy it. That's my task. And it's the same at Jesus' table. You could say coming to Nexus is like coming to a wedding party, right? And you go and you check the little list, right, where it's, well, what table are we going to be at? It's kind of like going, checking the list and going, oh no, I'm at table 13, the Nexus table. And oh no, Cousin Tommy's sitting there as well. This is going to be difficult. And there will be times, there will be moments maybe here in this community at this table where we think, oh, I wish Cousin Tommy wasn't here. I find Cousin Tommy embarrassing. He makes this table embarrassed. I don't like being around him. He acts so foolish. And we might be tempted, of course, to try to erect barriers or boundaries to keep Cousin Tommy from our table. But that's not how it works. It's not how it works. You don't get to control the guest list at Jesus' table. And despite maybe having our own Cousin Tommies here that we don't particularly like, for some reason at this table, we realize that the host, Jesus, has decided that this group of people would be a good fit for a table. We don't get control of the guest list. A Jesus table, a Jesus banquet, everyone is welcome. Everyone's invited. No qualifications. We don't get to make rules or policies that would exclude others because we are not the host. We're simply guests. And that's how we should come to this table as guests. Jesus made the guest list, not me. That's how we approach the table. And so every time we come to the table, the physicality of these symbols, the bread and wine, they speak to something larger. I think it's an invitation to come to Jesus' party. Jesus is hosting a party. He's made the guest list. It's an invitation for us to come and relinquish our desire for control, relinquish our desire to make sure that the people at our table are the people we enjoy and like and get along with. I don't get control of the guest list. And so to come to this table is to say, I will come and I will sit here with strangers, enemies, those that make me uncomfortable, those that seem unworthy to me, those that I don't see eye to eye with, those that bore me, those that anger me, those that I would never, ever put on my own guest list. But still, we come to eat and drink with them as friends, as equals. And why? Because I've been invited to a party, a banquet that Jesus is hosting. And this is all about learning to love. And so we come as guests. And so Jesus, on the night before he was crucified, he took wine and bread. And with the bread, he said, "This is my body broken for you." And with the wine, he said, "This is my blood shed for you." And the idea here, of course, is that Jesus is inviting us to participate, to eat of him, you could say, to ingest him. And that's one of the big ideas with communion, Eucharist, is we take these elements as a way, you could say, to ingest divine energy for the journey. It requires a whole lot of patience being in the school of love, learning to love people that we don't always see eye to eye with, don't agree with. And so we need Jesus' divine energy, you could say. This is the way we ingest that, by participating in this ritual, this meal. And so Jesus said, do this in remembrance of him. What does that mean? It means, of course, we do this to remember the Jesus path we travel is a hard and tricky one. It calls us to love those that we don't always get along with, to love of enemies, and to create a community around that that is willing to be open and allow anyone to belong and participate. And so we take these elements in remembering that in order to travel Jesus' path, we need God's spirit, we need God's energy, we need God's grace for the long haul of the path we are traveling together. And so friends, I'm going to invite you to take your own elements here at home as we remember together the body of Christ broken for you, the blood of Christ shed for you.